From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. It's a historic day in the House of Representatives. Lawmakers have passed the largest economic relief bill in U.S. history, a package worth $2 trillion. As you'll hear now, there were dramatic moments in the lead-up to the vote in the House chamber. Representative Thomas Massie, Kentucky Republican, objected to the proceedings. He said he wanted members to be present. Here he is talking with Acting Speaker Pro Temp Representative Anthony G. Brown, Democrat of Maryland.
Mr. Speaker, I came here to make sure our republic doesn't die by unanimous consent in an empty chamber, and I request a recorded vote.
A recorded vote is requested. Those favoring a recorded vote will rise and remain standing until counted. An insufficient number having risen, a recorded vote is refused.
Mr. Speaker, I object on the basis that a quorum is not present and make a point of order that a quorum is not present.
The chair will count for a quorum. Counted for a quorum is present. The motion is adopted.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us now. Claudia, what just happened there? What were we listening to?
Well, many of the House lawmakers wanted to get this measure approved on a very quick voice vote. They were hoping for no objections. However, Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, he's a fiscal conservative, and he said he was determined to try and get a roll call vote. That's basically what he was calling for. However, according to House rules, if there's a quorum present, they can basically shout down his demands and adopt the measure, which is what they did in that moment. So it was very dramatic, and they were able to get it through. But yes, a lot, it just goes along with the day and a more than $2 trillion measure that looks like it got approved today.
And it meant that a lot of lawmakers had to scramble into the House to make sure that they were indeed going to be present. That meant that they could not stay home. They couldn't shelter wherever they were.
Many did continue to shelter. However, they needed at least 216 members in there, and that's what they did. They had some special social distancing guidelines. So that meant members even sat in the public galleries and in the chamber to make sure they were spread out enough to where, as the chair, Anthony Brown, in that moment could say, yes, I see a quorum and we can move ahead. So about half of the membership at least was able to quarantine or stay home if they wanted to.
President Trump is excited about this bill. How soon might he sign it?
He has already announced he's signing it in about an hour. He has set a time of 4 p.m. Eastern to sign it at the White House because they want to get this moving as quickly as possible.
So the bill, soon to become law, then provides money for regular Americans and relief to businesses, large and small businesses. So after the president signs the measure into law, does that mean checks will be in the mail?
So that will be the plan. It'll be interesting to see how they handle this. Our understanding is that it will go according to 2019 tax filings. If those are not available, they'll look at 2018. If you filed electronically and you had a bank account attached to that where you got your money electronically through that bank account, it's very possible that those filers will get that money that way. However, if you did not file electronically or you didn't get your check through your bank that way, then it's possible they have to work on paper checks. So it's possible if you did file electronically, you're looking at a check in maybe about 3 weeks or so, but paper checks is going to be a lot longer.
And what kind of provisions are there in the bill for the healthcare system?
So healthcare is looking at aid of about $100 billion for hospitals, and that will help them respond to this coronavirus pandemic. It'll help boost equipment and treatment. And then there's also additional money for the healthcare industry to try and boost equipment overall when it comes to ventilators and masks.
In terms of relief, the bigger picture on this, of course, it's as you said, to the healthcare system, to ordinary Americans getting checks in the mail. How about in terms of businesses, large businesses, small shops as well? What's the overall effect?
So they'll be looking at the potential of applying for these low interest or no interest loans from the government. Small businesses, for example, will be able to apply for these perhaps in the coming weeks. Same for these larger businesses. When it comes to these larger businesses, they've set aside about $500 billion in loans for these industries, such as airlines. They will have to adhere to some guidelines. For example, the money can't go towards stock buybacks or CEO pay boosts, or they can't engage in layoffs. And so there'll be some strings attached, but they should learn more in the coming weeks.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, in the midst of a crisis when most Americans are stuck inside, social media has never been more important. So let's get to Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, to see how the news is filtering through social media. She is working from home today in Washington. And Femi, that's because of coronavirus.
It is indeed. We have in our office or in our bureau a colleague who was covering an event. At that event, there was somebody who believes that they have COVID-19. And so being very cautious and making sure that we don't impact any of our other colleagues or our families, we are WFH for the next 2 weeks.
Yep. Well, I'm WFH as well. Let's talk about social media and how it's playing into this. You flagged for us a new study from the Pew Research Center that finds people who rely on getting their news from social media are less likely to follow new developments about the coronavirus. Tell us more.
So Pew Research Center looks at journalism, looks at media and how people react and engage with it. And they found, looking at the coronavirus and where people are getting their news from, that about 2 out of 10 people in the United States get their news mostly from social media. And when they get their news mostly from social media, they may not be the best informed about the coronavirus. So 18% of them will be young. That's 18% of people getting their news in this way will be young and not particularly interested in politics.
And maybe they're getting some misinformation. Give us some examples of some of the rumors that you've seen going around.
Right. So, you know, you and I, because we spend a lot of time on social, we know that a lot of the stuff that's out there is great information and some of it is made up because we can all be our own publishers on social. So, for instance, a couple of myths that I can bust for you right now. Coronavirus was created in a lab as a biological weapon. That is false. If you hear anybody say on social, my high-ranking military friend, do not trust them. Unless you absolutely know somebody who's in the current administration, even then, check another source. Keeping hydrated will stop you from getting the coronavirus. That is not true. Do not believe that. If you see a picture of dolphins swimming in the canals of Venice, well, you need to double check that picture. Is it really Venice? And is it really because all of the cruise ships have disappeared from Venice? That picture, if you just double check it, you'll find that that came from southern Italy and not necessarily from this period in the last month or 6 weeks where the cruise ships were basically all going back to base. So that is not true. The WHO, the World Health Organization, described the myths as fighting an infodemic, and they have been doing that as much as fighting COVID-19. They said it's equally as important that people will have real facts.
Femi, healthcare workers on the front lines this week are sharing a hashtag on social media to advocate for more personal protective equipment. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, the hashtag is Get Me PPE. And now all of a sudden we're learning what that means. It's not just an acronym for healthcare workers, that personal protective equipment. It will be the goggles, it will be the masks and the special masks that stop droplets from getting into you, even gowns and cover-ups, all of those vital pieces of equipment. They have shortages, certainly in New York area and other areas which were not expecting such a huge amount of COVID-19 patients that they have to treat. So this is happening in Italy, it's happening in Spain, it's happening in the UK as well. So this is a global hashtag, Get Me PPE. Let me give you an example. I'm not going to name this doctor. He is on social. Both my wife and I are frontline ER physicians. With such a shortage of N95 masks, those are the real heavy-duty ones, we've had to resort to sharing one mask between the two of us. We even had to write our names on our one precious mask because now even nurses and doctors are stealing masks from each other. Hashtag get me PPE. That is why I did not name that doctor. And one other one, which is actually just more hopeful and is a beautiful story. This is Dr. Naran, who's out there in Washington State where there was a big outbreak around Seattle of COVID-19. And she posts pictures of masks and PPE equipment on her doorstep. I found two boxes on my doorstep. Thank you, whoever you are. This independent doctor is forever grateful. Get me PPE. Hashtag PPE is not optional. And if you're listening to this and you're seeing that hashtag online, go to getuspppe.org, and there are ways that you can help. If you happen to be a retired dentist, for instance, you've got a stash of gloves or cover-ups, or you feel you can make it, that is where you go, and then everybody will be able to work out where you go and where you can put your efforts into to help our medical professionals.
Femi, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And one more thing on the subject of doctors. Two doctors have a touching video that's being shared all over social media. Listen to this.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
These are doctors singing, Dr. Elvis Francois on vocals, Dr. William Robinson on the piano. They're both at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. We'll link you to this at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
We haven't heard much about the presidential race in recent days because of the coronavirus, but Bernie Sanders was on Morning Edition today, and Noel King asked him if he was continuing his campaign for the presidency.
We are assessing the situation we're in. We're doing a virtual campaign, if you like, but right now we're focusing on the healthcare and economic crisis facing the country.
Okay, that's interesting. I did expect you to just say yes. When you say you're assessing, what does that, what that means?
Some folks out there who say, you know, Bernie, you should go on and keep the fight going for the ideas that we believe in. Our ideas are the dominant ideology of the Democratic Party right now, and I'm proud of that.
Well, we are joined now by a supporter of Bernie Sanders, Francis Gill, who's 29 and a third-year medical student at Tulane University School of Medicine in New Orleans. Hi, Francis.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and do you think that Sanders should stay in the race at this point?
I think at this point, he should stay in the race because I think that what he's able to do with his campaign infrastructure that's been built and the political platform that he has is move his ideas forward and show how a lot of those ideas would help address like some of the issues that the coronavirus pandemic is really laying bare in our society.
But you don't think that he would actually be able to get the nomination at the end of the day? You just want him to stay in so that he can continue to have a bigger platform for his ideas?
I think that a path towards the nomination is definitely looking, it's not really looking doable at this stage, but I think that these ideas and the movement that he's built are still incredibly important, and there's still a lot to be gained just in moving those ideas and that movement forward by staying in the race.
So the big question that a lot of Democrats especially have is, will people like you who are devoted supporters of Bernie Sanders support Joe Biden in a general election against President Trump if Biden indeed becomes the nominee and faces Trump in the fall?
Certainly, like defeating Trump and winning back the Senate are critically important issues to me as a voter, and I think to most people. And that's honestly a big reason why I initially supported Bernie Sanders, because I felt that against Donald Trump, he really had the best chance. A broad working class coalition really energized young voters. I felt like he could beat Trump more handily than any of the other candidates. So certainly I'll support the Democratic candidate, no matter who they wind up being.
But do you think that other Sanders supporters are in the same boat as you on that, that they would also vote for the Democratic nominee, even if it's not Bernie Sanders?
I do think so. By and large, people that I talk to and people whose voices I hear do understand that it's critically important that we defeat Trump.
What was the main reason that you wanted Bernie Sanders to be president in the first place?
The issue that definitely is most important to me is Medicare for all. and the idea that we should have comprehensive, universal coverage that is free at the point of service for all people and for all healthcare needs. That was hugely important to me because I as a medical student, you know, I kind of see many redundancies and waste and bureaucracy and also just injustice that happens in our healthcare system. And we really need sweeping, comprehensive change. And then also from a personal level, I just, growing up, my mom was a bartender and never had health insurance because she worked in the service industry. And Bernie Sanders was the only candidate who really seemed to have full-throated support of Medicare for all. Not only that, but understood how urgently it was needed.
And what are your thoughts about the future of progressive politics if indeed Joe Biden becomes the nominee, and even if he becomes the president? Do you think that the issues that you care about, and not just healthcare, but maybe climate change as well, other progressive ideas are going to be able to move forward the way that you want?
I feel honestly tremendously optimistic about that. And I think that the campaign moved incredibly important issues forward by huge measures, and it also trained tens of thousands of organizers who care deeply about those issues.
That is Frances Gill, who's a supporter of Bernie Sanders, 29 years old, a med student at Tulane. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, show business has been hit hard by the coronavirus and its economic fallout. Theaters across the country are closed, and many actors have also lost side jobs in the hospitality industry or the gig economy. Sharna Halpern is the owner of Chicago's IO Theater, an institution in that city's improv scene, joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what is this like for you right now? You guys have suspended all performances until further notice because of coronavirus.
Well, yes, of course. There was a mandate that we had to close, and it's very scary. Our employees are out of work. We're all out of work. IO doesn't have an income, and the government says they're going to help us, and so far, they're not. You know, here's my point of view here. Up until now, we played this lovely game of the game of life where we had an income and we all paid, and not just IO, I'm talking about everyone. We paid our taxes, you know, all that stuff came from the income. And something very unprecedented has happened, and that game of life has got to stop as we know it. And the government, our local government, has to say, you know, we're going to take care of you. Our banks, you know, I work with BMO Harris for my mortgage, and they've been lovely. They stopped and they deferred my mortgage. They said, Sharna, this is our time to shine. And that's what our government has to say. They have to say, we're behind you, just like my bank did.
Is there anything that you're able to do for revenue at this point? Could you do online video content or sales of gift cards?
No, honey, you know, that's not we do online writing classes and stuff, but I'm talking about the fact that I have a property tax of over $100,000. The mayor told us that we have to do a relief program and pay all our employees for 15 days. I have an $80,000 payroll. Where does she expect that money to come from? There's no logic. You know, here are people, they're out of work. The stores are empty for food. People are panicking. They don't know what's going to happen. And what does our government say? Oh, we take care of you. You know, we're going to give you 12 extra weeks to pay your taxes. This isn't logical. When we finally open, we're going to need help. It's going to be a while before we're going to get back on track, and they have to help us.
What about the people who you employ, or people who come to the IO Theater and do shows there? Many of them are waiters or bartenders on the side.
Yes.
They're not getting any income there either.
Right, and they can apply for unemployment, and that's part of the problem. None of the websites are working. They said we can have an SBA loan. Every time you go on to apply for the loan, you get bumped up because there's so many people. I mean, everything is just in chaos.
Do you think you're going to be able to survive this?
I don't know. I hope so. I sure hope so. It depends on whether the local government helps us. All the bills, all the salaries, that comes from our income. We don't have an income, so we have to see if they're really going to help.
Meanwhile, of course, people come to the IO Theater to laugh. Is there anything that has made you laugh recently in the midst of all of this?
Not really. You know, right now, I just worry. I really just worry. We need help. And it's really got to be something for everyone. They're going to have to stay for a while, not forever, but just a short moratorium on property tax, on sales tax. We have to be able to get back on our feet. And it isn't just IO. It's everyone.
That is Sharna Halpern, who is the owner of the IO Theater in Chicago, an improv theater there. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Even with the uncertainty and worry the coronavirus has caused, people are seeking out and finding bright spots. This week, a video performance of the Burt Bacharach Hal David song What the World Needs Now went viral, the good kind of viral. The video features students at the acclaimed Berklee College of Music. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has the backstory.
It's a video made out of dozens of smaller videos. It begins with just four musicians, each at a different location, playing flute, harp, saxophone, and percussion. Then more videos of individual musicians are added to the screen. Horns, strings, guitars, bass, and vocals.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love.
Before you know it, you're watching a collage of individual musicians in separate locations playing in unison.
What the world needs now is love.
The 74 student musicians were all forced to leave when the Berklee campus closed because of the coronavirus. Senior Shelby Rassler, a composition major, found herself at home in South Florida, wanting to make music with her friends. So she posted an idea on her Facebook page.
I just asked if any of my friends would be interested in being part of a project to kind of keep the community alive and just kind of keep us in touch and collaborating.
Plenty of her friends, and some people she didn't know, were interested. Rassler wrote an arrangement and sent everyone sheet music and a track they could sing or play along to. She told them to take a video of themselves performing, either the whole song or just parts.
And then I imported everything onto my laptop and created what now exists online.
There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine. Go listen, Lord. If you want to know.
Rassler says the response has been incredible.
My favorite part about all of this, though, is the people asking how it's done because they want to do something like this.
Burt Bacharach, who co-wrote What the World Needs Now with the late Hal David, has seen the video. In an email to NPR, he writes, quote, "Very proud and honored to see and hear my song performed by these extremely talented students from the Berklee School of Music." Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
China says it will close its borders to nearly all foreigners as it tries to curb a new rise in coronavirus infections among people arriving from abroad. But while the world's second largest economy attempts to insulate itself from another wave of infection, it might not be able to prevent a second economic shock wave. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa.
China's manufacturing sector is coming back now as coronavirus infection rates decline. But the pandemic is still worsening, as we know, in much of the world, including in China's major export markets, Europe and the United States in particular. So what does that mean for Chinese manufacturers?
You know, the expression you hear a lot these days is that it's a simultaneous supply and demand shock. In other words, China first dealt with this illness by shutting down most of its factories, or at least many of its factories. So that's the supply shock that sort of the rest of the world felt the most, all the big importers of goods from China. But now China is able to reopen and start producing in their factories again, but they're being hit by a shock on the demand side. In other words, many customers in the U.S. and other countries that import a lot from China, they're simply canceling orders because their economies now are shut down themselves. So to boil it all down, economists are bracing for a big plunge in exports from China in the coming months, probably a double-digit percentage drop in exports out of China. And remember, that is exports had really been booming from China as a real source of growth for their economy. So this is a major hit to their economy.
So two issues there. What's it going to mean for China, and what kind of ripple effect might that have for the United States economy?
All right. So the main threat to the economy in the U.S. right now is purely domestic, you know, how the virus has caused just huge parts of the economy to simply shut down. But you're right that the U.S. and China economies are inextricably linked to each other. They do have a big influence on one another. So this any weakness in China's economy is likely to be yet another headwind to the U.S. economy as it tries to recover from this.
We've heard some epidemiologists are worried that we could be dealing with cycles of infection in different parts of the world until there is a widely available vaccine against COVID-19. Are we seeing something similar here with the economic fallout of this pandemic, anticipating waves?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is this risk of sort of a rolling weakness in various economies around the world that sort of ricochets back and then sort of affects the economies that may be recovering from this. So it's, you know, the world's economies are so linked to each other that, you know, weakness in one place can affect the rest of the world.
And so how would governments and central banks of the world break that cycle?
You know, I think governments and central banks are doing everything they can to basically mitigate the damage, to try to sort of put out the fires and prevent it from snowballing out of control. I do think it's unrealistic to think that they'll be able to counteract all of the damage being done. You know, a vaccine for this virus or some evidence that the virus spread has slowed is really what the economy needs. I mean, the governments and central banks are doing what they can, but they're fighting a very much an uphill battle against this virus.
Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the things that makes coronavirus so scary is that we just don't know enough about it to be able to predict what will happen. The only thing we know is that if you stay isolated, you can't get it or give it to someone else. Still, politicians and policymakers are trying to look into the future to take the steps necessary to get past COVID-19 with the least possible damage. And one person who might be able to help with that crystal ball is our next guest. Epidemiologist Larry Brilliant, the doctor who helped eradicate smallpox and is now chairman of the board of Ending Pandemics. Larry Brilliant joins us now on Skype. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So in a 2006 TED Talk, you described what the next pandemic would look like. 1 billion people sick around the world, more than 160 million people dying. Does what's happening now have the potential to be that bad?
Well, I think it has the potential for infecting more than 1 billion people. I'm optimistic that for this particular virus, which has a relatively low death rate compared to smallpox and others, that the death rate would be less than that. But as far as its disruption, yes, it's every bit as disruptive as I feared.
Well, and as you've been thinking about the numbers, one of the places that's popped into your head is Youngstown, Ohio. Tell us why.
Well, I have relatives in Youngstown, Ohio, and it has a population of around 80,000. And that's the number of new cases of COVID added every day in the world. That's also the number of cases that the United States has had from the very beginning of the epidemic. And probably the best health statistician in the country is Chris Murray at the University of Washington. He thinks that more than 80,000 Americans will die of COVID in the next 4 months. A city the size of Youngstown, Ohio, that many people dying in the United States in the next 4 months.
So what does that mean that the federal government should be doing right now?
We've had such a failure of leadership from the federal government. We should be, you know, demanding, I guess, that states and counties have plans for the next 2 years, their own plans. We should have a Manhattan Project for antiviral drugs, a moonshot for vaccine and ventilators, and especially a real thoughtful plan on when we are going to clamp down with social isolation, quarantine. We don't have any of those things. And really, that's what we've always had in the past from the federal government. And I have to tell you, I miss it.
When you say 2 years, the next 2 years, do you think this is going to go on for the next 2 years?
Well, I don't think it's going to go on with the intensity that it will go on in the next 4 months. But certainly it's going to have a long tail. By the way, I just read that 9 out of 10 Americans today are doing something to self-isolate, to wash their hands. That's something we can be very proud of. And that's to flatten the curve. But when we flatten the curve, we don't reduce the number of cases of the epidemic in its lifetime. But by pacing it, we reduce the number of deaths because we can care for each case better. And we also reduce the number of deaths from heart attacks and trauma and all the other things that we usually take care of all the time. Yes, I think we need a plan for a couple of years. There'll be a very big difference in 12 to 18 months when we have a vaccine. Then it will be a question of vaccinating everybody as quickly as possible and then mopping up all the hotspots in the world with a measles, smallpox, polio type of almost eradication program.
Do you think it's possible that some treatment will come up in the next couple of months that will get us through it faster than 2 years?
Oh, I'm absolutely confident that we will have an antiviral that works, but it'll take us a little while to know which ones work and which ones don't work. And then it'll take time to do safety trials and then get it into production. By the way, I talk always about a vaccine, but it is possible, and I'm optimistic, that we will find an antiviral that not only is curative, but is also preventative. Mm-hmm. We have one now for HIV/AIDS, and we know that Tamiflu would stop an outbreak of certain influenzas. So we know that antivirals can be used as surrogate or pseudo vaccines. It'll be a lot easier to manufacture billions of doses of an antiviral. I'm hoping that we find an antiviral that is not only curative, but is preventative. I'm confident of the former in the next 4 months. I'm hopeful of the latter.
What about the calculation that some are making that the cure could be worse than the disease? In other words, shutting down the economy will lead to more death and devastation than just leaving it open.
You know, I understand where that comes from. I mean, it's so hard to think about the empty streets of San Francisco. You watch the stock market and people are unemployed. 3 million people applying for I understand where that comes from. Unfortunately, it isn't our choice. The virus leads us, and taking our, it's like a patient who's sick, taking our medicine now will prevent half of the deaths that we expect otherwise. I mean, if you look at what Chris Murray said, 85,000 people dying in the next 4 months. And if you take a look at the models that are coming out of the Imperial College in England, it suggests that there could be as many as 2.5 million Americans who die during the course of this disease. If we practice strong isolation techniques, all the things we know we must do, we'll reduce the number of deaths by at least half. That's a huge number of people to trade off for a short burst of quarantine-like effects. The economy is terribly important, but people are first.
What do you think that President Trump should be doing right now when he speaks to the nation? These daily press conferences have been criticized by a lot of people because they end up veering into territory that has nothing to do with coronavirus. He goes after some of his political rivals. And it sounds to some like a campaign rally. What should he be saying to the country?
I'm not happy with these, but it doesn't do any good to criticize. I urge President Trump to announce 3 moonshots. 1, to get antivirals quicker. 2, to get respirators and ventilators made cheaper in the United States right now. And 3, to work on test kits and to get so many test kits that they're so cheap, they're done at home like home pregnancy tests. If we do this with the power of the federal government, we create a buying consortium so that industry has a price signal that makes them put in the effort to do a Manhattan Project or a moonshot. These 3, they would be able to really stem the tide of this epidemic.
We should say that you were also the senior technical advisor for the pandemic horror film Contagion, which a lot of people are watching right now.
I reject that characterization. It's not a horror film. It's an accurate film.
Okay, fair enough. But anyway, you are the senior technical advisor. What would you say to listeners who are just really scared about what's going on right now?
I would say that the virus, the fictional virus that we created in the movie Contagion, is far worse than COVID. That virus, which killed upwards of 10 to 30% of people, you know, that was a fictional virus. We made that movie in order to kind of refute the sentiment in the country after the swine flu of 2008-2009, where people thought, ho-hum, if that's what a pandemic is, I'm not worried. We wanted to, you know, kind of rejigger people's sentiments so they understood what a real pandemic would look like. And in that sense, the movie is prescient. It shows the disease beginning in a bat, going through an intermediate animal, going through a human being, the cook, with blood on his clothes, and then transmitting it with a handshake to Gwyneth Paltrow, and who, poor dear, we kill off in the first scene. So in that sense, I guess it's a horror film. But it's not. It's scientifically excellent. That's not what we're experiencing. But it is important to see the social disruption that Scott C. Burns wrote into that film, because we will have social disruption. If I could say one more thing, all the characters from Contagion have agreed to do PSAs, and you'll be seeing them coming out this weekend or next week, and each character will say something about whether your hand washing is important, social distance, all the things you actually can do, and we hope that we'll get a lot of play on that so that people can use those same characters that have frightened you to now help you kind of figure out your way through, navigate the next few months.
That is epidemiologist Dr. Larry Brilliant, who is chairman of the board of Ending Pandemics. Dr. Brilliant, thank you so much for speaking with us, and stay safe.
And you stay safe and healthy. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And Dr. Brilliant also wanted us to point listeners to the website COVID Near You. You can answer questions about your own health and track coronavirus across the country. We will link you to it at hereandnow.org.
The first lesson a student in medical school learns is how to put on those thin, stretchy, protective gloves. It's also the second and third lesson. It's that important. And it's really important to know how to take them off. The gloves are personal protective equipment, or PPEs, and they're essential to keep medical staff safe. But so many non-medical people are using them now, so we have invited an expert to tell us the correct way to put these gloves on and to take them off. Dr. Naheed Bedelia is an infectious disease physician and the medical director of the Special Pathogens Unit at Boston Medical Center. Tell us how important, with COVID-19, these protective gloves are.
Yeah, the biggest reasons gloves may help in those situations is that you are doing a lot of work picking up things that might be contaminated, and you're providing direct care to people who might be sick. And the gloves allow you to take that off and protect yourself by washing your hands right after.
Okay, so with the gloves that you have there, if you can put them on and describe how you're doing it, and more importantly afterwards, take them off, because that's a huge factor. So first, tell us how you put them on.
Sure. First and foremost, even before you put your gloves on, you have to wash your hands, or you have to sanitize your hands. And the reason why is because if your hands are dirty, you're just putting those dirty hands into the gloves. So I'm currently I'm sanitizing my hands because I'm not near a sink. And there's a great website on WHO. WHO has a great sort of pattern how you do this to completely clean your hands. You then take the gloves, you put the gloves on, ensuring as you're putting them on that there are no tears and there's no bits of the gloves that are disintegrated, so that you can get full protection. So now you do what you need to do. And the next step that you take is you reach for the wrist of the first glove. Try not to touch your skin, because if you touch your skin with the dirty gloves, you're going to get sick. So you pull up from the wrist without touching your skin over your fingers of the first hand. And you've inverted the glove at this point, and you dispose of it.
Go back to after you clean your hands. I'm unclear on whether both gloves are on now or not. So after you clean your hands, then what?
So you clean your hands. Next thing you do is you put on the gloves, and you're doing that right now. You put the gloves on. And after you put the gloves on and they're on, you'll take a look to make sure that there are no holes or no breaks in the gloves. Sometimes if they've been affected by heat or if they've been stored for a long period of time, that's a concern. Now you provide the care that you're providing or do the task that you're doing. when you're ready to take them off, find yourself near a trash can, because you don't want to put the gloves anywhere else. You want them to go straight into the trash where nobody else will touch them because they're contaminated. When you take them off, you take the fingers of your first hand and create sort of a pinch motion, and you reach for the base of the second glove without touching your skin. You don't want to contaminate your skin with your dirty glove.
And when you say the base, you mean the part around your wrist?
The part around my wrist, exactly.
Okay, and you're not touching your skin at the same time?
You are not touching your skin at the same time because you do not want to touch your skin with the dirty gloves.
Okay, so then with the second glove?
So what you do is you pull the first glove off, inverting it, and then throwing it into the trash directly. The second glove, you put a finger underneath the glove. This time you are touching your skin because you don't have a glove on the other hand. You put a finger under the second glove and you invert it again outward and you throw it into the trash can gently.
Because you don't want to touch the outside of that glove.
Exactly. Because at that point, your second hand is bare. Your first hand, rather, is bare.
And then do you have to wash your hands after?
That's exactly right. Because you don't know if you did end up contaminating yourself in that process. So the next thing you'll do is go to the sink and wash your hands with soap and water.
Now, this is best medical practice. Is it necessarily something that we have to do at home?
Oh, the same principles apply. If you're using the gloves, you should be using it the right way. The principles around washing your hands, the principles around not contaminating your skin when you take off the gloves, and making sure you dispose of them right away so that other people do not come into contact with them.
I've actually seen a bunch in parking lots and outdoors kind of discarded. I saw one yesterday along with a mask. I'm not sure who thought that was a good idea.
It's a disaster, right? Yeah, exactly. And so then, you know, what makes you worried about people who clean this trash out there and whether they have personal protective equipment, because now they're having to touch these dirty gloves and masks without any protection.
Any other words of advice?
That would be the major one. But I think for most people, the main thing is, you know, knowing how this disease is transmitted, hand washing and making sure you don't touch your face with your hands is the major thing.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bedelia. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Naheed Bedelia is the medical director of the Special Pathogens Unit at Boston Medical Center. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Remember that you can find all of our coverage of COVID-19 at our website, hereandnow.org. We would also love to hear from you. This is something that is impacting everybody. You can go to our Facebook page or you can find us on Twitter at Here and Now. This is Here and Now.